The Spirit and a Stick, Chapter 9, Respect the Game. That the young men who use the stadium may better learn the rules of sportsmanship, the value of teamwork, and the worth of competition. Given in memory of our classmates who have died in our nation's service. Class of 1951 Gate, Navy Marine Corps Memorial Stadium. Lewis visited Robbie again on the third Sunday of the month, and they walked together to the wall. What would you like to talk about today, Robbie? I've been wondering about what you mean by respect the game. Can you tell me about that? Lewis began his answer as they walked. Well, that's a rather difficult question. I must say that my philosophy of the game reflects the many great players and coaches with whom I've had the opportunity to work during my career. Most notable among those people were Terry McDonald, my high school coach, who had a tremendous impact on me and countless other high school players, and Willis P. Bildy Bilderback, my coach at the Naval Academy, who also taught me a great deal about the game and myself. I was also extremely fortunate to have played with tremendous athletes who were dedicated to improving themselves and their teams. They were always an inspiration to me. And of course, all of my discussions with Mr. Turnbull and Red Hawk. What I have to say about Respect the Game is really the sum of the interactions with all of those wonderful men. I should also say at this point that most of what I will say probably applies to all of your athletic endeavors, most of your schooling, and regular work. So let me give it a try. Respect the game is a concept that takes some time to understand. I think that its full appreciation is gained over a period of time and usually corresponds to the amount of effort and work you've invested in the game. I think at its core, respect the game means to play the game as it was meant to be played in antiquity, but within the current rules. Robbie listened intently as they continued to walk. Above all else, the essence of lacrosse was and is its test of endurance and physical strength. So in order to play the game well today, a player must be strong, physical, and in top shape. Only after achieving a sound physical base can a player's physical courage and skill become useful. Lacrosse of today requires fidelity to the age-old and inherent physical rigors of the game. To play lacrosse at its highest level, a player must be strong of mind, body, and spirit, and must not yield to fatigue. Lewis lobbed the ball off the wall to Robbie as they arrived, and they both began to work the skills Lewis had demonstrated on his last visit. Also, to respect the game, a player needs to develop the skills required by the game, to be able to handle the stick as though it were an extension of his arm. Players today need to be adept at throwing, catching, scooping, dodging, and shooting with either hand. This requires a great deal of concentrated and systematic effort. In order for a team to play at its highest level, each player must contribute his best efforts. This means to exercise the proper skill at the right time, which often means using the proper hand, like this, Robbie. Say you're running along the left sideline against pressure, and you need to make a pass to a teammate 30 yards away and upfield. You must throw that ball left-handed. If you don't, your mechanics will suffer, and you'll either throw a poor pass or be checked. So being able to use both hands is important. Back in the old days, most players were restricted to one hand. Mr. Turnbull pointed this out to me when I first met him. He encouraged me to learn to play with both hands, so I worked hard at it. He talked of balance, of equal skill left and right, as balanced as the stick he gave me. I once spoke to Tom Mitchell, a Turnbull Award recipient from the Naval Academy class of 1961, who told me that he played every fall season at the Naval Academy with his left hand exclusively in order to become more comfortable and adept with that hand. Mike Buzzle, another recipient from Navy, told me the same thing. I think there is a lot to be learned from Tom's and Buzz's approach. Young players today can exercise that tactic in fall ball, summer league, and camp. I think that sportsmanship and team spirit also come into respecting the game. This is perhaps more reflective of the game and the role of athletics in society today. One of the roles of lacrosse in Native American life was to prepare young men to become warriors for combat. As a result, games were often extremely rough and physical. Preparing for war was, and still is, serious business. The elders in the tribes who had engaged in battle with other tribes or with European settlers knew the horrors of such engagements. War is not for the faint of heart or body. A tribe's entire safety and way of life were frequently determined by the outcome of a particular battle. The ancient Greeks knew this as well. You can see from the modern Olympic events that physical strength, speed, endurance, and close hand-to-hand combat skills were highly prized. Again, all of these physical attributes aided the clan's safety. Warfare has evolved, some might say devolved, quite a bit over the centuries. Today, direct physical mano-a-mano engagements don't play as crucial a role in warfare, though physical rigor is still a critical and necessary element of training and on the battlefield. And there's no doubt in my mind that long-term physical, mental, and emotional endurance are critical to success in war. When I was a fighter pilot, we all knew that there were no points for second place. They continued to throw against the wall. So sports have evolved from being ancillary training for war to an end in themselves. Our society today continues to place a high value on physical prowess, and I believe correctly so. It has been the key to the survival of our race. But it seems to me now that knowledge is the real key to power in our world, not necessarily individual physical strength. We now live in a society that generally rewards education more than brawn. Nonetheless, it's not difficult to accept the inherent value of physical strength, speed, and endurance, as these can contribute to and be representative of good health. Yet despite all of the cruel and barbaric aspects of armed conflict, there's also been a significant human element implicit in war. That remarkable aspect has been reflected in the victors' treatment of the defeated and prisoners captured in battle. In only the most barbaric instances would entire groups of innocent non-combatants, the elderly, women, and children, be slaughtered after the outcome of a battle had been decided. After hostilities have ended, prisoners are likewise treated humanely and repatriated to their homelands. Though there are surely countless historical examples of violations of these general precepts, the treatment of American prisoners of war in Vietnam comes immediately to mind. Fair treatment of the defeated or captured has long been a part of the human endeavor, and so it is today. So as athletics have developed over the centuries from a more direct role in preparation for combat to what they are today, a means to physical fitness, physical prowess, physical courage, teamwork, and many other laudable traits, sportsmanship has taken on more importance. I think it is important to prepare and play the games as if for battle, but to win and lose graciously, because it is, after all, a game and not war. It is also important not to attempt to deliberately injure an opposing player. The game should be played within the established rules as hard as it can be played, but at all times fairly. I've seen war, and I've seen peace. Sports are not war, nor should they be. They should be a physical and emotional test, yes, but they are not war. Facing Lewis, Robbie listened intently as he worked his skills. Robbie, don't underestimate the significance of the Johns Hopkins University Turnbull Reynolds Award for Outstanding Sportsmanship and Leadership, which is sponsored by the class of 1932. The men of that class were members of the undefeated Hopkins team that represented the United States in the Los Angeles Olympics and won the gold medal. They obviously feel pretty strongly about sportsmanship, as it was clearly one of the shining traits of each of those heroic men. You know about Jack Turnbull. Pete Reynolds was an All-America cover point defenseman who died on the Bataan Death March, also in World War II. Team spirit is another aspect worth mentioning at this point. One of the things that I've found over the years, particularly as a naval officer, is that leadership is extremely difficult, much more difficult than I'd ever have imagined when I was your age. It's far too easy for people to be negative. My high school coach did us a great service by stressing the phrase, "Don't expect anything to be easy. You're not going to accomplish anything just because." He taught us to stay positive and to support each other, regardless of the situation. He always stressed the importance of the team and the value of hard work. He was a big believer in the thought that when talent is roughly equal, the player or team that works harder will always come out on top. We had a lot of average players, but we practiced harder than most teams. Vice Admiral Edward C. Waller has established an award for the Navy Lacrosse Program, which is presented each year to the midshipman who has contributed most to the spirit, morale, and well-being of the lacrosse team. I believe that Admiral Waller, who was a multi-sport letterman during his midshipman days, as well as a superintendent later on, has shown great wisdom in establishing this award, very much like the class of 32 from Hopkins. As an athlete and naval officer, he knew firsthand how critical individual and group spirit and morale are to the mission of a unit. It is quite remarkable to me that in one of the letters Mr. Turnbull showed me from his brother, Jack mentioned that beyond his regular duties, he was always concerned about the welfare and spirit of the team. I was struck by how he used the term team to describe his military unit. There is something to be learned from this individual and collective insight of these two great military leaders. Robbie was absorbing every word as he pounded the wall with his ball. Let's see, what else? I guess discipline's another aspect of the game that falls into this category. When we talk about discipline, we usually think of parents punishing their children. But in terms of team athletics, discipline means to play the way you practice and practice the way you play. I think this is one of the most critical aspects of playing a team sport. Each player is obligated to conform to the guidelines set by the coach. There can really only be one vision for the team, and each player must accept that vision. It's not unlike doing battle in the military. In order for the team to win, each person must do what he or she is trained and expected to do. Anything less can spell disaster. In naval aviation, we had the phrase, train like you fight, fight like you train. Discipline involves things like making good decisions under pressure, sticking to fundamentals when you get tired, not allowing yourself to let down when things get tough. I think that all of the other things I have mentioned before play into the concept of discipline. It is easy to say and difficult to execute. You often hear, move your feet or get down on ground balls and things of that nature. Well, they're all true and even more so when you get tired or things aren't going well for you or your team. I've also found that talking doesn't make your team better. Doing does. The only ground ball that matters is the next one. The only face-off that matters is the next one. We could say that about every aspect of the game. The key to being able to exercise discipline in games is to execute fundamentals repeatedly, correctly, and at full throttle in practice. So everything you do is either a good habit or a bad habit. How well and how hard you do things in practice will dictate how well you do them in games. So when your coaches bark about fundamentals and little things, don't underestimate their significance. They almost always determine the outcome of a contest. I have also seen the same in my experience as a naval officer. I think Mr. Turnbull would have said the same things about the game 50 years ago. So respect the game takes many forms. Appreciating the history of the game, conditioning yourself physically and mentally, developing the skills of the game, sportsmanship, teamwork and team spirit, and discipline. That pretty much covers it. What do you think? I think I understand it a little better now. Chapter 10. Het Achterhuis, The Diary of Anne Frank. I want to go on living even after my death. Anne Frank. Red Hawk came to visit Robbie again on the next full moon. Where would you like to go this time, Robbie? Red Hawk asked. Captain Lewis said that the meaning of the book, Het Achterhuis, would become clear to me. Can you help me with that part of the story? Sure, let's go. Red Hawk took Robbie to Lewis's home on Long Island on his 16th birthday, February 23, 1960. Doug Turnbull made it a point to visit Lewis on this day and had scheduled a business trip to the area. After dining with the family, Turnbull was preparing to leave. The unseen guest looked on. As Doug reached the door, he turned to Lewis and handed him a book. Happy birthday, Jim. I don't know how familiar you are with this book, but my mother gave it to me shortly after it was published in the United States in 1952. The title of the book literally means The House Behind, referring to the secret annex that Anne, her family, and another family occupied for more than 2 years. She asked me to read it and then the letter at the end. I'll ask you to do the same. Perhaps after you do so, you'll understand why it's so important to me. It might be of some use to you. With that, Turnbull headed for his hotel. A short while later, as Mr. Turnbull requested, Lewis began to read Anne Frank, dutifully planning to save the letter until he finished. Lewis, however, was not as patient to look for the diary entry on the date of his birth, Wednesday, February 23, 1944. He felt a rush of excitement as he found an entry for that special day. As he read it, he thought of the fact that the Holocaust had actually occurred during his lifetime. He read eagerly. The best remedy for those who are afraid, lonely, or unhappy is to go outside, somewhere where they can be quite alone with the heavens, nature, and God. Because only then does one feel that all is as it should be, and that God wishes to see people happy amidst the simple beauties of nature. As long as this exists, and it certainly always will, I know that there will always be comfort for every sorrow, whatever the circumstances should be. And I firmly believe that nature brings solace in all troubles. Riches can all be lost, but that happiness in your own heart can only be veiled, and it will still bring you happiness again as long as you live. As long as you can look fearlessly up into the heavens, as long as you know that you are pure within, and that you will still find happiness. At this point in his life, Lewis hadn't given a great deal of thought to the majesty, mystery, and yes, magic of nature. But he was certainly struck by the power and eloquence of this girl, who was nearly his age when she put her thoughts to paper. Spurred by this passage, Lewis began to contemplate the larger issues of natural law. Red Hawk advanced the scene forward a week after Lewis had completed reading the diary. He and Robbie looked on as Lewis slipped the letter from its envelope and read. August 18, 1952. Douglas. It's difficult to believe that it's been almost 8 years since we lost Jack. At times it seems like yesterday, and at others it seems like forever ago. I should start by saying that a mother can never completely reconcile the unspeakable pain of losing a son. I am no exception. Having to do so without your father has made it doubly difficult. I shall never be able to patch the gaping hole in my heart. I have always wanted to believe that Jack's loss, though, was justified in some way, specifically by helping to end the senseless, heinous, and widespread persecution of so many innocent people. This amazing book has put my heart at some ease, knowing that Jack and his crews, though unable to spare this brilliant young woman, may have prevented a similar loss of even one innocent young girl like her. I have finally achieved some solace. I know how much you already adore your children, but I hope that after reading this book you will be moved even more to cherish every single second you have with them, particularly your exquisite girls. I have copies of this book for each of your children. At their young ages, they will likely not fully grasp the power of this work, but perhaps they will begin to learn something about the injustices of the world, and despite reading of the worst aspects of human nature, they may still believe in hope, as young Anne did. I am sure that as they grow older, they will appreciate it as much as I do. It is nearly impossible to believe that such insight, wisdom, compassion, hope, and beauty resided in the heart and mind of a 15-year-old girl. We were fortunate to have had Jack for as long as we did. The poor father of this girl must be suffering infinitely more than we are. I simply can't imagine the horrors that were being perpetrated at the hands of the Nazis. My heart breaks for every single person who was exterminated simply because of race or religion. War hardly ever seems like the best solution to conflicts between people or nations, but in this case, I can't see that there was any other way to stop these unspeakable atrocities. I know what the loss of Jack has meant to you. I know that you've carried your loss silently deep in your heart, unseen by most people. A mother can sense the pain of her children, and I know that you've suffered much more than you've shown. I know that your feeling of loss is as deep today as it was so many years ago in 1944. But I beg you to continue to carry only the memories of Jack's goodness and heroism. Don't carry the pain of his loss. Please continue to channel any of the hurt into something good, as you have done so admirably over these last 8 years. I think of Jack and your father every day, as I know you do. But we continue to bear the obligation of living our lives for today and tomorrow, to love and help our children, and to retain hope in our futures. I often think of the only request your father made of his children, that you give more to this country than you take. You've all done that so, so well, each in very different but equally important ways. I couldn't be more proud of you and all that you've done. You are a truly special son, brother, father, and citizen. Your father would have been extremely proud of you. All my love, mum. Red Hawk then took Robbie to the Turnbull home the day after Mum's funeral, July 16, 1957. After all of the guests had returned home, Doug finally had some time to himself. He sat in his den and began meticulously inscribing the shaft of the stick with a tribute to his mother and brother, a carving of the cover of Het Achterhuis. It took Doug about 8 hours to do that carving, Red Hawk shared. I hope that gives you some sense of the role of that book in the history of the stick, Robbie. Once again, Robbie shared his dream with his parents and recorded the visit in great detail in his journal.